This podcast is brought to you by MITEX, the Massachusetts Innovation and Technology Exchange, the region's premier association for thought leadership, technology trends, building business relationships, and professional training and development. For more information, go to www.mitx.org.
Paul Mader is that rare venture capitalist with a sense of humor and a willingness to admit to the occasional mistake. Once, when I spoke with him, he even offered up examples of several startups that he declined to invest in, but which later turned into big hits. To err is human, and to regret is human, he said. The trick is to learn from it once you're done with the self-flagellation. After graduating from Harvard Business School, Mader went to work for Charles River Ventures. It was there that he met Bob Higgins, with whom he later started Highland Capital Partners in 1988. Mader has been an early backer of several companies that eventually went public, including the digital editing company Avid Technology, Sybase, and CheckFree, a pioneer of online billing and payment. Mader's also a pilot, and he serves on the board of Avidyne, a company that makes high-resolution cockpit displays. I'm Scott Kersner, the at-large columnist for the Boston Globe. When I visited Mader in February 2005, I opened by lobbing a softball, asking him about the smartest thing he'd ever done as a venture capitalist.
Probably one of the smartest things I did was not bickering about price when I invested in Sybase, either the first or the second time. I invested in Sybase first when I was at another firm at Charles River. And there's another venture capitalist who to this day rues the day that when the management team said we'd like 65 cents a share, he said, well, how about 55? And I said, deal. And it was a very, very successful investment by any measure. Although negotiating price certainly has an important role in venture capital, and although walking away from some investment opportunities based on price is a really good thing and an important discipline to maintain, we can't lose sight of the fact that we're not, to use a mutual fund term, value investors. We're momentum investors. We're growth investors. And you can easily get caught up in a prideful cycle of negotiating really hard and being really steely-eyed about a deal, and in the process, walk away over a 5 or 10% difference in price in a deal that is going to make you 5 or 10 times your money. So,
how did Sybase turn out?
Sybase turned out very well. I don't remember exactly what that pre-money valuation was, but when we formed Highland, I think it was single digits for sure, single-digit millions. And when we formed Highland a number of years later, 3 or 4 years later, we invested again at a $100 million valuation, which at the time was an extraordinarily high valuation. Everybody said, you're crazy. And I said, maybe we're crazy, but this is a management team I've worked with for 3 or 4 years. I know them. I know their shortcomings as well as their strengths. I know the product and I know the market. I can either put capital in them or get on another 20 red eyes and meet another 20 management teams that I don't know and try to figure it out. And in the end, probably only know 10% of what I should know before I make those investments. Or I can put money with people that I know and trust. I did that, and I made 20 times my money on that investment as well.
How about, I mean, you talked about not haggling over price to the point where, you can lose a deal because VCs aren't value investors. Are there other things that you find yourself going back to as kind of key rules or key principles that guide you in the practice of venture capital?
Oh, yeah, there are hundreds of them.
Uh-huh.
I probably can't come up with any of them spontaneously. But, yeah, I mean, oh, God, yeah, there are tons of them. And this is a pattern recognition business. And after a while, you start to notice things. You don't have to be a genius after having backed 40 or 50 companies to know what's going to happen next in the formation and growth of a company. And that's a lot of the value we bring to startups. It's not that we're inspired or we have some secret playbook. We've just seen the same things happen again and again and again. And from a social value standpoint, from a public policy standpoint, that's why we deserve to exist in the economy. Mm-hmm. Because we really are, if nothing else, we're experts at the company formation and company growth process.
How about the one thing that you've done, either an investment that you did or an investment you passed on, that you look back and say, boy, that's the one thing I would redo, I would get in the time machine to have
well,
a chance at that?
This business is probably the Olympics of regrets. You know, there is so much opportunity for regrets in this business. It's phenomenal, as in any investment business, but particularly this one. The people that you didn't invest in and the people that you did. There is naturally a bias in this business. The cost of overage greatly exceeds the cost of underage. When you don't do an investment that ultimately becomes a great company, you have regrets and you say, boy, woulda, coulda, shoulda. But you still get to watch a company from afar and say, at least I had a chance at it, and at least I knew that it was happening and I was in some small way part of its formation. But when you do something that you shouldn't have done, it's in your face every day, every week, every month, for years. You pay a huge price for mistakes in this business. So you tend to have a bias to say no when you have significant concerns.
What's a concrete example of one of those where you really learned by investing when maybe you shouldn't have?
You mean my mistakes?
Or just the one that you learned the most from, where you know where you said yes and it didn't go the way that you would have hoped?
Oh, God. Too many. You want me to start crying, Scott?
That is the goal of these interviews, to have a Barbara Walters moment.
Well,
you don't have to name names.
I understand that. Let me just try to give you a thoughtful answer.
Yeah, this broad outline.
There is a company that I invested in that I was involved with for 13 years, the full length. I invested... Venture funds last 10 years, but you have the right to extend them 3 years, and they almost always go into extension years. This was a company I invested in at the beginning of a fund, and I finally sold it for about 2.5 times our money after 13 years. Not a very good ROI. And the first mistake I made was to invest in a husband and wife team. I'll never do that again, even though there are some famous husband and wife teams, like Stanton, for an example, in the cable world, that have done well. I'll never invest in another husband and wife team. Second mistake I made was that when I was negotiating price with them, I thought I was a brilliant negotiator because I was making a lot of headway. It turned out he was easy to negotiate with, because he wasn't a very good business person.
So the customers could negotiate with him as well as easily as you did.
You got it, and everybody else. And so, you know, you've got to be careful what you wish for. When you get it, sometimes it's a bad sign.
Why did you pick that one? I'm curious because, I mean, you must have an example that you could have picked about a company you invested in and that never got sold, that, you know, just disappeared, vaporized, vanished from existence.
Because those were trivial and stupid mistakes. Uh-huh. Those were mistakes of impulse. Uh-huh. What happens in the business is there's so many analogies to dating. You get really excited, and that excitement blinds your skepticism. And that's why this business will always be a partnership business. Mm-hmm. Because your partners don't fall in love with your deals. Only you fall in love with them. Partners are like parents of teenagers, and they can see
you. Chaperone you.
They chaperone you. They see you going over a cliff, and woe be to those who don't listen to their partners. And you know, I don't know whether anybody's ever compiled the investment track record in aggregate of angel investors, but my guess is it's probably not great compared to venture capitalists, because they don't have that
sanity check.
There's no check and balance.
Yeah.
And fortunately, we have that. So But there are, you know, stupid mistakes where I made a poor judgment, where I did things that were the result of impetuousness or not thoughtful analysis. This particular company I'm mentioning, there was another major mistake with it. They really didn't have a proprietary technology. They had an innovative software delivery mechanism. And ultimately, that was not proprietary and not sufficiently compelling to allow them to do well. And boy, what a mess it was. I mean, the degree to which the pillow talk between the CEO and his wife had destroyed the culture of the business and made it unattractive for anybody good to be there was really astounding.
How hard do you think it is, use Highland as an example, how hard is it for an entrepreneur that is completely unknown to you guys to get a meeting here and get the chance to pitch their startup?
It's impossible. It's not hard, it's impossible. If somebody can't figure out a way to get into us through somebody we know, then how are they ever going to be able to recruit good people? How are they ever going to be able to find good customers? We spend all our time making ourselves available. We market ourselves. Customers don't market themselves. Customers don't raise their hand and say, here I am. They don't put ads in the New York Times saying, come sell to me. We do. And so if you can't figure out how to get to us without cold calling us, then you probably should consider a different career alternative from being an entrepreneur. Entrepreneurs are people who should be in the middle of resources, combining those resources in clever ways, pulling them together, starting with absolutely nothing, and creating something purely on the promise of a vision. And they're very much like universities. Universities are really mythical things. Why do people go to Harvard or MIT? Well, because there are other smart people who've already gone there. So the smartest people want to go there, and so the next smartest people want to go be with those people. But if you strip away at the core, it's really nothing. There's no asset. Their classrooms look like any other school's classrooms. Their labs may be a little bit nicer, but there's really no difference. What a company is creating that winner's circle aura out of nothing. Out of nothing, creating a perception that the best people want to go there because other best people are there or will be there. And that's a very difficult thing to do. And there is no cookbook recipe, despite all the books that have been written about entrepreneurship, there is no cookbook recipe for charisma and for creativity. And that's ultimately what it's about. It's the ultimate creative act, building a company.
Have you ever, I imagine people must buttonhole you at cocktail parties and industry events and when you speak on panels and say, hey, I've got a company that I want to tell you about. Does that ever work out well?
It's never, somebody doing that and nothing else has never resulted in an investment. For me, or I don't think anybody else at Highland, and probably that's true for most of the institutional venture firms in the Boston area. However, if somebody buttonholes me at a conference and then maybe follows up with an email and then I hear 3 days later from somebody I know and trust that this person's terrific and then 2 weeks later I hear from somebody else, obviously that will get me interested.
What do you think about first-time entrepreneurs? Let's say someone gets this meeting, right? They're here in one of your conference rooms. They're presenting a business. Is it naturally, and let's say you have a business that's a B-plus business being presented to you by a first-time entrepreneur, and the next day you have a B-plus business that's being presented to you by someone who's sold a company before or built a good company before?
Well, obviously past is prelude, and people that have done something before give you more confidence that they can do it again. Look, there's a pernicious myth in American culture that anybody can just do this. They can wake up one day. And nobody ever said, maybe I'll go to a Washington law firm tomorrow and ask them if they'll let me argue a case before the Supreme Court. Nobody ever says, maybe I'll go to Mass General tomorrow and try my hand at brain surgery. But people do say, well, you know, I just got out of college a few weeks ago. Why don't I try starting a company? Everybody does it. Seems easy. And there are a few classic examples of people doing that, or at least it's perceived that people did that, Bill Gates and Michael Dell. In fact, they didn't. In fact, they had very professional help all along the way. They had godfathers. They had people giving them lots and lots of guidance, and often they weren't in sole operating roles. And they were also very unusual circumstances at the birth of industries, when there really wasn't any experienced talent around. In fact, 99% of the companies that get built by people who have single-mindedly, systematically built the skills to run a company by watching how other people do it. And there's, you know, there's no question that someone who's run one successful company is more attractive to us than someone who's run none. Someone who's run two is more successful, more attractive than someone who's run one, assuming they haven't run out of steam. And someone who has worked alongside someone who's built a successful company but never done it themselves is probably the most attractive candidate to fund.
Really?
Yes. Absolutely.
Because they're hungry?
Because it's their turn to do it. They're going to make more mistakes than the other guys because there's nothing like doing it yourself. It's like driving a car. You can ride around with your mom all you want, but the first time you take the wheel, you're still going to learn a lot. But the fact is they've learned styles that work, styles that don't work. They've learned modes of decision-making, organization. They've had a pattern recognition experience with recruiting. They've done all that stuff, and they've always been itching to do it themselves. And for us to give them a first crack at doing that is both very exciting and in many ways the most promising opportunity we see. If someone has done it before, you always have to ask the question, well, why aren't they still doing it? This guy was so successful building a company. Why is he talking to me? Why didn't this company become a Fortune 500 company? And he's running it still.
I'm sure there are other instances, though, where someone might have built a great company and sold it or taken it public, and the second time around, they just don't have the drive that they did the first time.
That is possible.
Do you not see that a lot?
You know, I think about 20 or 30% of people, substantial accretion to their net worth changes the way they look at things and their drive. But then there's another 60 or 70% of the people whose personalities really don't change just because there are a few more zeros in their checking account. Mm-hmm. I mean, it really doesn't make that much difference. The bottom line is if they are going to become entrepreneurs successfully, they have to have such innate, almost irrational drive that which stems from not from their perceived poverty, but from their childhood, from youth experiences, from role models, from their DNA, that some degree of wealth isn't going to change that. And you know, the thing about wealth is always more wealth. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you reach one level, you're always focused on the next level. So,
how about those entrepreneurs? You must run into them sometime. Who want to start businesses that are not traditionally venture-fundable businesses. You know, they want to start, you know, the next Staples or the next Kabloom, or they want to start, you know, pick your, I hate to focus on retail businesses, but, you know, maybe they want to start, you know, a company that makes high-end furniture, you know, handcrafted furniture, what have you. And you often hear them being frustrated that, you know, we have this great venture capital community here in the Boston area, but, you know, they pretty much just fund IT and biotech for the most part.
Well, there are a number of good reasons why they do. First of all, from the perspective of an entrepreneur, you probably shouldn't raise venture capital unless you need to. If you're in a relatively slow growth business or an existing industry where you're going to be another player and just going to do a better job and grow that way, you don't really need venture capital. If you're in a service business, you don't really need venture capital or consulting business. You need venture capital when there is a finite window of opportunity. And if you don't get through that window, other people will and they'll beat you. And those other people happen to be funded by venture capital. And unless you have sufficient capital to grow fast enough and establish a presence fast enough to hit that window of opportunity, you're going to lose. That's a pretty narrow set of businesses. And it's typically businesses defined by human beings doing something new for the first time that they've never done before, that once they do it, it'll become old hat. That's technology. That is the definition of technology. What is high tech? High tech is what didn't exist when you were a kid. That's the only reasonable definition of high tech, of technology. When I was a kid, TVs were technology. When my dad was a kid, airplanes were technology. Today, airplanes are commodity, and TVs are commodity. Nobody would start a television business. And tomorrow, blade servers will be a commodity, and we all know that. Venture capital only makes sense at the cutting edge of new abilities of human beings to do things.
How does that explain something like Staples? I mean, there are some companies that, you know, lots of companies that have become successful. I think Staples was a VC story,
yes.
Right?
Yes, it was. Yeah, it was.
Not you guys, though?
No, not us. Staples did something very new. Staples, Tom Stenberg recognized that there was a wave coming of people centralizing retail, that smaller, decentralized retailers with less selection and, above all, limited bargaining power and access to low-cost merchandise from distributors and manufacturers we're going to be overwhelmed. We're going to be passed over by big box stores. He was at the beginning of the big box trend, and really, number one, he took advantage of a demographic change, which is of course the suburbanization of America, which was sort of completing when he got Staples started. And he was taking advantage of the fact that the stationery business was up until that point overlooked. By the way, the hardware business was also, because that was before Home Depot and Lowe's and so forth. But he also took advantage of some things that weren't possible before. The information you can get from computers at point-of-sale terminals, improved logistics.
But so you would make the case that sort of business, if you were starting a business today that had a lot of those characteristics in common with Staples in terms of, you know, seeing a big industry shift that was happening, you think that business could get funded by that?
Sure. Staples would not have been successful in 1955. Mm-hmm. Staples could have only been successful when it got started. And venture capital makes sense for businesses that are only possible now and will only be new and innovative for a finite period of time. You don't need venture capital to start a restaurant or to do, you know, a 10% better job at a service business that's been around for 100 years.
Can entrepreneurs learn anything when they come in and they give their pitch to a venture capital firm? Can you learn anything from... Should you learn anything maybe from the feedback that you get in the room, and can you learn anything from the decision that eventually gets made not to invest in you?
I think fundraising is one of the biggest learning opportunities an entrepreneur has early in the days of formation of a company. For the same reason that taking tests in college are learning experiences and board meetings are learning experiences. First of all, there's enormous value in the preparation. There's enormous value in saying, all right, I've got to figure out exactly what we're doing, why it's unique, be able to tell it to somebody in 10 or 15 slides in 45 minutes, and then respond to penetrating questions for another 45 minutes and come out of that feeling pretty good about it. I mean, that you learn a ton just by that process. Good professors will say you don't ever really know a subject matter until you teach it. That's when you really learn and you really work out. I learned this in college, but I never really understood why this little corner of theory held true. Now that I'm teaching it, I better understand it. So first of all, preparation is a huge learning experience. Secondly, venture capitalists, by the very nature of their questions, will direct you towards the risk points in your business plan. And thirdly, if they take an interest and they begin due diligence, you're going to learn a whole lot during that process.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting because when I've sat in on pitch meetings here at Highland and in other places, you often see that the entrepreneur, they are very focused on their presentation and, you know, coming across really confident. But a lot of them never make the switch when they're done with the presentation to, let me actually listen to what you're going to say versus, I'm going to let you talk, but my mode is still kind of a defensive mode of, you know, I need to defend my
idea. I need to keep selling.
Right.
Yeah, it's very hard to do. It's a very difficult balance to strike between sounding open and being open and not sounding like you haven't thought your ideas through. But, as you know, as we all know, the best managers aren't really bosses. They're helpers. They're people who sit around and help their employees be more productive. And by the same token, the best CEOs are people who have strong opinions and express them, but are also absolute sponges for different ideas, different viewpoints, different approaches, and can learn from every interaction. You know, the most charismatic thing and the most impressive thing about Bill Clinton, and everybody says it's true, is his ability to listen, not his ability to speak. He's not, you know, by nature a particularly charismatic speaker, but in a one-on-one encounter with a man, you feel like he is just, you know, made you the center of the entire universe and listening so intently.
So you're saying it's You're saying it's not a bad thing in that pitch meeting if an entrepreneur listens rather than projects this master of the universe persona.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I'm coming in to present to a venture capitalist. You got to recognize a couple things. Number one, the best way to sell is to buy. The best way to sound like you're in a strong position is to be a buyer, is to come into the meeting and say, in a very nice, socially appropriate way, tell me about your venture firm. Why would you guys make the best partners for us? You're sending a huge subliminal message that, number one, you've got choices. Number two, you're smart enough to know that all money isn't green. And number three, you're putting the folks in a position where all of a sudden they're having to think, they're having to come up with reasons, with arguments, and they're not just sitting there evaluating you. It subliminally changes the relationship.
It doesn't come off as arrogant to say, you know, okay, Highland, you know, I've got lots of choices. Tell me why I should take your money.
Well, you don't say it that way.
Uh-huh.
You say, tell me a little bit about Highland. How'd you guys get started? And tell me some of the, you know, companies you've had a big impact on. I'd really love to reference check you guys along the way, if that's okay. Because obviously fit is important and it's a two-way relationship. We're going to be business partners, right? And just by saying that, you've communicated that you're at a different status than most entrepreneurs. You understand the process. You understand how it's going to work. You understand the nature of the relationship. So number one is come in buying as well as selling. Number two, you got to recognize that the best way to make somebody happy is not to make them listen, but to make them talk. And of course, what's everybody's favorite subject? Themselves. So merely by asking some venture capitalists to tell you about their backgrounds, you're going to get them in a good mood. You're going to wake them up, for one thing, because they're not just sitting there listening. And number two, they're going to be able to tell you what makes their firm special and what makes them special. You're also going to learn a whole lot, and it should really color how you present to them. You're going to hear what they're interested in, what they like, what they don't like. It's called blueprinting a customer. It's sales 101. The first thing a good salesperson does when they show up at a company is not start talking. They first find out what the customer needs, what their problems are. Everybody in every office in America is frustrated with something at any given moment. If you go in and you start talking at them, all they're thinking about is their frustrations. You got to ask them about their frustrations. And you say, terrific, that's great. You know, actually, we can help you with that. That's the way you sell. And if you can't sell, you shouldn't be an entrepreneur.
Do you have any good stories about companies that maybe made a great first impression on you, but that for some interesting, funny, unusual reason, you just wound up not investing? You know, where it seemed like, hey, this is a great opportunity for a business, but you ultimately, at the end of due diligence, said, we can't do this?
There are many, many, many examples of that. And that's why we spend as much time as we do on due diligence. The fact is, many people come in who are very charismatic and who are great salespeople, and the first pitch, you walk away saying, wow, that's fantastic. And what we typically do is we then go out and visit the company with one of our partners who might not have heard that first pitch and ask them to present the pitch again to the naive partner. And now the partner who's already seen it, seen the pitch, can hear it again. And you know very quickly, it's a great technique for finding out how deep the entrepreneur is really is and how deep their knowledge is of their area. If you happen to notice that they're telling the same jokes at the same point in their presentation, it starts making you very uneasy that you may have already penetrated the full depth of their knowledge of the subject area.
Is there any story that comes to mind, though, just about an interest, you know, a scenario where due diligence revealed something where you said, okay, we're just, you know, we feel like the opportunity is intriguing, but we just can't do this deal?
No, no specific ones. Okay. I mean, there are situations all the time where we get turned off to things through due diligence, either people or ideas. And we, of course, never reveal what it was that triggered our turn down.
You never reveal to the entrepreneur?
No, because we never want to violate due diligence sources' confidentiality.
Can entrepreneurs have a relationship with a venture firm after they've been rejected? I mean, is there any way, say you turned down my business, a way to do that graciously?
Some of my best investments were investments that I turned down and then later invested in. That's another real mark of a savvy business person as opposed to a rookie. Someone who understands that the first turn down is just the beginning of the relationship. That we're going to be bumping into each other a lot. And at some point in the future, may well be right. Maybe the second round, maybe when I reformulate the business plan, maybe when I you know, listen to what the venture capitalist has told me. And you never, when a venture guy turns you down, you never argue. You know,
what's the best thing you can do? Just say, you know,
thanks a lot for that feedback. Could you just help me understand a little bit how you came to that conclusion? Because I'd really like to improve my plan and my chances for success. And, you know, and bore in a little. Don't ask 8 questions, but sound interested in their view and learn from it.
Like what was for you was the biggest factor in...
Yeah.
Not investing.
And I would say, you know, was there anything in our reference checks that turned you off? Or is it really the business concept? Or, you know, I'd say, were there some people in your firm that were less enthusiastic about the idea than you? Or, you know, did you find lots of competitors in the marketplace? There are lots of things you can learn from a venture firm that's done a good job. And, you know, there are times when we're a little more blunt. If we really like an entrepreneur and a management team and we've done some work on them, we will say things like, you know, you've got a great team, but it's a stupid idea. Come back when it's a better idea. Don't waste your time. Please, do me a favor. Do not waste your time on this. You'll spend 2 years of your career uselessly. Or we might even go to one member of a management team and say, you know, I was really impressed by you. I think your team... You know, I don't think you've got a backable team, but if you decide to strike out on your own, come on back and we'll talk.
What's an example of a company where you rejected them once but later invested in them?
Let me think. And undoubtedly paid a higher price. I've done that a bunch of times.
I mean, is Abbott an example there? I'm trying to think of all the stuff that you...
No, Abbott I invested the first time I was exposed to the opportunity. Same with Sybase, same with CheckFree. There have been some, but I can't remember. There's some really good examples of that, but I can't think of them. Oh, I know one, SQA. SQA, which is sold to Rational. What's his name? Wallingford, the technical founder, came and presented software quality automation. And I thought it was too early in this market space. So I said, interesting, let's stay in touch. Another venture firm funded him. And then a year and a half, the deal came back to me with Ron Nordine as the CEO, who's an experienced guy, and it had the right combination of now a strong management team and a market that had come along and developed in the intervening couple of years, and I invested, and it was a very successful investment. You know, being late is really bad. Being early is bad. And, you know, the best thing in venture capital is to be a little bit early and develop and husband your resources really well while the market catches up with you. Being way too early is terrible because you run out of money and you run out of steam, you run out of morale in the company before the market really comes along, and you can catch the wave.
Let me ask you one or two last things, and then we'll finish. What are some ways that the entrepreneur-VC relationship can go sour once the investment has happened? Or I guess the flip side of that question is, what are some things you can do to make sure that stays a good relationship once you've got a partner or two from the venture firm on your board?
Well, we renovated a house about 7 or 8 years ago that we moved into where we live now, and we had a contractor who had a very interesting style, very bright guy. It was a very successful business in primarily in renovations. Whenever there was an issue, any issue, we didn't like something or somebody done something in a poor manner or there were some design changes required, his style was, okay, let's get together tomorrow at 7 a.m. And the next morning, we were there with the subcontractor who had the issue, with whoever needed to be there, instant over-communication. And it's the same thing for partnership with entrepreneurs. The way to have the relationship go sour is to surprise each other. And it works both ways. And it's the venture capitalist obligation of the entrepreneur to make him know how firm the ground he's standing on.
In what way?
Well,
I mean, I've never thought of how a VC can surprise the entrepreneur.
Well, for an example, if the VC has drawn a conclusion that one of the members of the management team is weak and probably isn't going to make it, he should tell the CEO that right away, immediately. Immediately when he starts developing doubts, not let it get to the boiling point. And then all of a sudden the CEO says, well, boy, I wish I knew you felt like that way. I would have given it more serious thought 6 months ago, and we would have saved 6 months. Or if the company's going to need funding.
We're thinking we might not want to lead this next round sort of thing.
Yeah, we're thinking we might not want to lead the next round, or we're thinking the next round ought to be an internal round, or it ought to be an external round, or we ought to do it this way or that way. Over-communicate.
Yeah.
Tell them early. And by the same token for the CEO, if there's a negative surprise coming, I've got some CEOs that are absolutely fantastic at communicating, like Patrick Morley at Improvato. He's just a great communicator, and it's partly because of his sales experience. Good news or bad news, I always feel like he's telling me 10 minutes after he figured it out.
You're saying, there's a constructive way to have strategic differences with your venture investors and to just kind of hash it out in a way that doesn't get...
Believe it or not, there are very, very few strategic differences in company. I've been involved with companies now for almost 20 years, and I can remember only once when a board decision came down to an actual vote where people actually raised their hands, and it was already a public company. The fact is, decisions get made by consensus, and any decision in business, most decisions in business that get to the board level are decisions under enormous uncertainty. They're decisions where everybody's on the fence. And so it's so rarely a question where one person digs in their heel and says left and the other person says right. It's almost always a discussion. And so strategic differences are relatively rare. Now, people are challenging each other all the time and challenging each other's thinking. And there's a lot of disagreement as you build up to a consensus. But by the time you're organically ready to make a decision, people are in line usually.
So the very last thing, challenge any part of this question that you don't agree with, but over the last few years, we've heard people in the venture industry complaining that there's too much money in the venture industry, and we're funding too many companies in each little niche of the technology world, and even in the biotech world, too. How does that affect the companies that you invest in, and what advice do you give them if they find themselves in one of these niches where, you know, they're a security company and there are 200 other security companies that have raised just as much money as them, or they're an RFID company and there are 200 other RFID companies? How do you, as an entrepreneur and as the VC who's on an entrepreneur's board and kind of providing advice, I mean, how do you deal with this environment? And I guess part two of the question is, do you see this changing anytime soon?
Well, overfunding of market segments is as destructive to progress as underfunding them. And there is no question there are segments that are vastly overfunded. And it's partly an artifact of the fact that there are too many venture capitalists. The money is less part of the equation. There are just too many people, in my view, in the venture capital industry. Now, every business person will tell you they have too many competitors. Yeah. We'd all love a monopoly. But I think by any objective measure, there are too many venture capitalists. And I think eventually the limited partners who fund venture firms are going to realize that and pull back, but they have not shown any signs of doing so yet.
They look at venture capital as, hey, this is an asset class. We need to put a certain percentage of money into this asset class and keep going.
Yeah. And I don't even think it's an asset class. You can't get in and out of it. It's not an asset class in any normal sense of the term. Mm-hmm. The advice I give to an entrepreneur if they find themselves in a space that's overfunded is sell, partner, get out as quickly as you can, because musical chairs is no fun, especially for the littlest guy in the game. For people thinking about starting businesses, find something different. Find something unusual and find something where you bring unique skills or unique technology. Because it is no fun being being the 11th horse in a 10-horse race. It's just no fun. And we are constantly looking for new things at the risk of, you know, sometimes our limited partners. Everybody hates, what's the psychological term? I can't remember what it is. Everybody wants things in nice, neat little boxes. So our limited partners would love us to say, we do things in these two or three industries and we'll always only do things in these two or three industries. And we take risks in new industries regularly. Cognitive dissonance. And we create cognitive dissonance among our investors at risk to ourselves because we really think it's our business to find new stuff. And stuff that 3 years from now people will say, oh man, why didn't I think of that?
You touched on it before we started the interview, but I mean this notion that there are just some parts of technology, I mean maybe it's the desktop PC and the software that runs on it that are just really mature. And maybe there aren't a lot of great opportunities for, a new application that's going to run on the desktop PC.
There are great opportunities. They're just not obvious. If they were obvious, they wouldn't be so great.
Right. I guess I'm just trying to say that a lot of the areas that VCs have invested in over the last 20 years might have gotten... You're shaking your head.
Doing the same old stuff is an oxymoron, is an inherent contradiction with venture capital. And there's a lot of same old stuff that gets done when there are too many venture capitalists around. It's natural. But it's not particularly new to the industry. I mean, this was first popularized with Bill Salmon's case on Winchester disk drives, which were overfunded in 1985 or 86, mm-hmm. or 83. The fact of the matter is it's part of the industry, it's part of innovation. It's part of the human experience. I'm sure there were way too many sculptors funded in Florence during the Renaissance.
And you don't see, you're not holding your breath waiting for the situation to change?
I don't know. I don't think it's going to change anytime soon. I think it is possible that the industry will, at some point in the future, have a real big shakeout and go into screensaver mode. But I don't see anything that's going to trigger anything as cataclysmic as that. And if that happens, even if I'm 95 years old, I'll come right out of retirement, because that'll be the time to get started again.